The death toll from the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza nears 19,000. Palestinian fighters remain engaged in heavy fighting, inflicting heavy losses on the occupation forces. Pressure is mounting on the Israeli Prime Minister as he fails to free the captives from Gaza, while three of those held are killed by the regime's own forces. And Yemen's armed forces say that they have conducted new drone strikes against Israeli targets in the south of the occupied Palestine. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Palestinians in Gaza wake up to another day of Israeli bloodshed as they have been facing an unending nightmare of airstrikes and shelling for over 2 months. A fresh attack by Israeli warplanes on two homes in the northern strip has claimed at least 14 lives. Those killed were transferred to a medical facility in the city of Jabalia, but many still remain under the rubble of the bombed-out buildings. Meanwhile, bodies of 8 Palestinian students have been found at a school in the Jabalia refugee camp. Those students, in addition to a number of other civilians, were killed execution style some days ago. Israel's genocidal war in Gaza is now in its 71st day. The death toll is nearing 19,000, most of them women and children. Medical facilities are not spared from the regime's violence. The Israeli military has completely destroyed the southern part of Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has carried out retaliatory operations against Israeli soldiers in Gaza in response to the regime's onslaught on the blockaded territory. The Al-Qassam Brigade says that it has destroyed an Israeli infantry division in a building east of Khan Yunis, south of the besieged Gaza Strip, with anti-personnel carrier missile. The group said its forces also destroyed 3 Israeli tanks south of Deir al-Bala. Another Israeli armored vehicle was also destroyed in the same area. Since the war began on October 7, the Al-Qassam Brigades has managed to inflict heavy losses on Israel. The Israeli military says nearly 120 of its soldiers have been killed in Palestinian retaliatory operations since the regime launched its ground operation. The Al-Qassam Brigade says the Israeli fatalities are multiple times greater than what the regime is acknowledging. We conducted an exclusive interview with the Deputy Political Bureau Chief of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Let's take a listen to an extract from the interview where Saleh Al-Aruri talks about the significance of the Palestinian Al-Aqsa flood operation.
How has this operation changed the point of view of Hamas towards the occupation, towards their army that was undefeatable? I think that you have something to say about their army, especially we're seeing their defeats on the ground in Gaza.
The Al-Aqsa flood operation on October the 7th surprised and shocked the extremist Israeli regime. Firstly, the army and intelligence were taken aback, and then the Israeli public. Resistance groups thought it necessary to wake up the Israeli regime and its people, as well as turn the attention of the world public that the Palestinians will never accept their rights being forgotten and ignored. The Palestinian people can surprise the enemy with bigger and stronger operation. Ignoring the rights of Palestinians will even undoubtedly harm the world's stability. The world now is watching what's going on in Gaza.
UN officials have sounded the alarm over the worsening humanitarian situation in Gaza. They say no place has been spared from Israeli airstrikes, including locations that should be protected under the law of war. UN officials say half of the population in Gaza are starving.
UN agencies continue to sound the alarm bell over the desperate humanitarian situation in the besieged coastal territory. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that the people of Gaza are running out of time and options. Philippe Lazzaroni warned that Gaza is very far from an adequate humanitarian response.
The people of Gaza are running out of time and options as they face bombardment, deprivation, and disease in an ever shrinking space.
He described the situation in Gaza as hell on earth and said people in the Palestinian territory are facing the darkest chapter of its history since 1948. He described seeing people halting in aid truck and in desperation and swallowing down the food found inside where they stood in the street. Further noted that the people of Gaza are now crammed into less than one-third of their original territory near the Egyptian border, and the dire situation might spark an exodus. The city of Rafah on the Egyptian border, the only crossing where aid is entering Gaza, has seen its population explode from 280,000 to more than a million.
Rafah is the epicenter of the displacement of the Gazan. There is over 1 million people who have fled in this governorate, most of them, as we know, have been moved more than once since the beginning of the war. Rafah has quadrupled its number of people overnight, and especially when the offensive in the south has started.
UN officials have warned that any such exodus would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and it would make a problematic Palestinian problem more difficult. It is now widely believed that the Israeli regime is deliberately targeting residential areas and the critical infrastructure in Gaza in order to make the territory unlivable for its residents. Israel has already pushed the U.S. and its other Western allies to persuade Egypt to accept Palestinian people in the Sinai Peninsula.
It seems very difficult to us that if there was a population movement outside Gaza, I think that can only mean Egypt. It would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and that would make a solution to the Palestinian problem even more difficult.
The healthcare system is collapsing. Expect public order to completely break down soon. And an even worse situation could unfold, including epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. I said that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system.
Doctors in Gaza are now warning about the spread of diseases due to overcrowding conditions that are occurring at makeshift camps. They say the situation is particularly alarming among children. This comes as infection cases have already surged among young patients due to poor sanitation services. And this has raised calls for urgent action to avert a looming catastrophe.
UNRWA and many other aid organizations have already issued serious warnings about the dire conditions in Gaza. The UN Humanitarian Office also said that Gaza faces a public health disaster due to the collapse of its health system and the spread of disease. Doctors in Gaza are warning about the spread of diseases, especially among children, due to overcrowding and unhygienic conditions of makeshift camps, as well as the lack of medicine and clean water there. The lack of food, clean water, and shelter have worn down hundreds of thousands of traumatized people, and with the health system on its knees, its inevitable epidemics will rip through the territory.
We all know that the healthcare system is or has collapsed. We've got a textbook formula for epidemics and a public health disaster. This is in part, of course, because the shelters have long ago exceeded their full capacity, with people lining up for hours just to get to a toilet.
According to the data compiled by the World Health Organization, from November 29th to December 10, cases of diarrhea in children under the age of 5 jumped 66% and climbed 55% for the rest of the population in the same period. The UN agency said the numbers were inevitably incomplete due to the meltdown of all systems and services in Gaza because of the war. Doctors of the pediatric ward at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza have told reporters that the ward was overrun with children suffering extreme dehydration, causing kidney failure in some cases, while severe diarrhea was four times higher than normal.
The conditions of the war have led to the spreading of a lot of epidemics and sicknesses, the first epidemic of which has been one of acute gastroenteritis, which we have most frequent cases of in the children's ward. There are a number of patients come with cases of extreme dehydration, some of which can get to the point of kidney failure or weakening kidney function. Things are very bad.
I have four children with gastrointestinal diseases and flu. My youngest son has a cold, but we don't have any medicine. I have never felt as helpless and miserable in my life as I do now.
Since the truce between Israel and Hamas collapsed on December 1, hundreds of thousands of people have moved to makeshift shelters, abandoned buildings, schools, and tents. Many others are sleeping in the open with little access to toilets or water to bathe.
Children sleep in the tent, while some adults have no choice but to sleep on the streets. There's no food, no water. The children lack milk and diapers. The situation is dire, with no sanitary conditions or toilets. toilets.
Gaza's 2.3 million people now find themselves in a daily struggle to find enough clean water to survive. Residents are forced to take seawater for daily use, despite health risks.
Let's bring in Zafar Bangash. He's the director at the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, who joins us. Zafar Bangash, welcome to the program. Our first piece of news, and I'm going to read just the parts of it in terms of what's happening there in the Gaza Strip. You have 14 lives that were lost in the northern part of the Strip based on warplanes that attacked it. You have students, eight of them, that were found dead at a school in Jabalia refugee camp. And you also have, on top of that, since the students were mentioned, a number of them to have been killed execution style some days ago. We're watching a genocide unfold in front of our eyes over and over again on a daily basis. And from the time that the U.S. used this veto power at the U.N., about 800 or so Palestinians have been murdered. What comes to your mind when you hear these stats and the way that it's this whole thing is unfolding in front of us?
What we see and hear and witness is this relentless genocide that is going on against the Palestinian people in front of the whole world. And the U.S. is actually complicit in the Zionist crimes by giving Israel not only billions of dollars in aid and weapons, but at the same time, even vetoing a Security Council resolution to bring about a ceasefire so that this genocide can stop. So what we are actually seeing is the barbarism of the Zionists, their American allies, and their European allies against the Palestinian people. And these people are they are committing war crimes. They need to be hauled and tried for war crimes and punished for war crimes. And unless and until they are punished, unfortunately, they will continue to perpetrate their genocide. So in the past, we used to hear that, you know, this country is committing crimes, that country is committing crimes. Now we are witnessing it right in front of our eyes. They are killing civilians. The Israelis demand that the Palestinians move to a particular area, and when the Palestinians move, the Israeli planes come and they bomb that very area. And in fact, even the route that they had chosen or suggested for them, they bomb that. As your footage shows, there is lack of clean drinking water. There is widespread diarrhea among children and among adults because there are no toilets, there is no food, there's no medicine. It is a total catastrophe. It is actually genocide by different means. Number one, by bombings, and number two, by starvation, and number three, by disease, because there are no medicines, no clean drinking water. So this is a catastrophe that we are witnessing right in front of our eyes.
Thank you for that, Zafar Bangash, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Thank you. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has carried out retaliatory operations against Israeli soldiers in Gaza in response to the regime's onslaught in the blockaded territory. The Al-Qassam Brigade says that it has destroyed an Israeli infantry division in a building east of Khan Yunis, south of the besieged Gaza Strip, with anti-personnel carrier missile. The group said its forces also destroyed three Israeli tanks south of Deir al-Bala. Another Israeli armored vehicle was also destroyed in the same area. Since the war began on October 7, the Al-Qassam Brigade has managed to inflict heavy losses on Israel forces. The Israeli military says nearly 120 of its soldiers have been killed in Palestinian retaliatory operations since the regime launched its ground operation. The Al-Qassam Brigade says the Israeli fatalities are multiple times greater than what the regime is acknowledging. Hundreds of Israelis have held a protest in Tel Aviv demanding that the regime make efforts to release captives that are being held by Hamas. The protesters first gathered outside of a military compound and then marched to the city. They call for negotiations over the release of dozens of Israelis held by the Palestinian resistance group in Gaza. They also blame Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the killing of three of the captives on Friday. The trio was killed by the regime's own invading troops. Israel's incessant bombings and shelling had earlier killed some other Hamas held captives. More than 100 of Israelis remain in custody in Gaza. That's after a week-long truce in late November, which saw Hamas swapping more than 100 captives with 240 Palestinian women and children held in Israeli jails. An Israeli soldier has reportedly been killed and three others injured by a drone attack. According to media reports, the attack took place in the Mar Galiot area near Lebanon's border. One of the injured is in critical condition. Lebanon's Hezbollah has not commented on the incident so far. Tensions have intensified in southern Lebanon since Israel began its deadly campaign in Gaza in early October. Since then, the resistance movement has staged hundreds of anti-Israel operations. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a drone operation targeting Israeli positions south of the occupied territories. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the operation, involving a large number of drones, hit sensitive targets belonging to the Israeli military in Rashrash, also known as Eliat. Sari said such operations will continue until the regime stops its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. On Friday, the Yemeni armed forces targeted two Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea. The attack came after the two ships refused to respond to warnings by the Yemeni naval forces. Danish shipping company Maersk said that it will pause all container shipments through the Red Sea. The company said its shipments would be sent on a detour around Africa until further notice. French shipping group CMA CGM has also halted all shipments through the Red Sea. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, has said, "If you are filled with joy when you are with us, the Ahlul Bayt, in the upper reaches of the heaven, then be sorrowful when we are sad, and be joyous when we are joyous."
In the limelight.
According to a new report released by Standard & Poor's Global, the Eurozone economy contracted at the fastest pace in nearly 3 years in October, as demand across the single currency union deteriorates. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Bloomberg News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. According to a poll of analysts that revealed on Monday, 11th of December, the 20-nation euro currency bloc will slip into its first recession since the pandemic in the final months of the year, after recording two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. Gross domestic product, or GDP, in the eurozone shrank by 0.1% between September and December, compared to the previous forecast of a flat performance, with economists expecting a moderate recovery next year. Jorge Anguele, an economist at Bantleon Bank, said, "We doubt that we're at the start of an upswing. Headwinds remain strong, especially the ones stemming from the massive increase of interest rates." In its recent report, the Statistical Agency of Europe, Eurostat, attributed the downturn to shrinking industrial production in the euro area, indicating the region's enduring weakness. The recession is largely attributed to the slowdown in the German economy, as the EU's largest economy continues to struggle with a combination of poor external demand, a budget crisis, high interest rates, and a protracted fallout from last year's energy crisis. Germany is expected to see a 0.2% downturn in the fourth quarter of this year, more than the 0.1% decline initially projected. Bloomberg's survey followed a downward revision of growth in the 20 countries that used the euro as their currency for the last quarter of 2023. The results of the poll came in contrast to the European Commission's November forecast, which predicted the euro area would return to growth in the final months of the year, driven by a retreat in inflation and a strong jobs market. Economists expect inflation in the eurozone to ease somewhat only through to September of 2024 and remain elevated well above the European Central Bank's target of 2%. British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story. Former Italian Prime Minister and European Central Bank President Mario Draghi said the European Union will likely plunge into recession by the end of the year. According to a preliminary estimate by the Statistical Agency of Europe, Eurostat, the eurozone economy shrank by 0.1% in July through to September compared to the previous quarter. The newspaper quoted Mario Draghi as saying on Wednesday, 6th of December, "It is almost sure we are going to have a recession by the end of the year. It is quite clear the first two quarters of next year will show that." The wider European Union economy reportedly grew by 0.1% in the third quarter of the year, and the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, said recently it expected broader European growth to rebound from 1.3% this year to 1.5% in 2024. However, the Financial Times claimed Mario Draghi's outlook on EU economic growth is downbeat. Draghi chaired the European Central Bank in 2011 through to 2019. He singled out the region's low productivity, high energy costs and lack of skilled labour as weaknesses contributing to the economic slowdown. He also said that Europe has lost competitiveness to the United States, China, South Korea, and Japan over the past 20 years. Russia Today, the RT network, has also covered the same story. According to a new report released by Standard & Poor's Global, the eurozone economy contracted at the fastest pace in nearly 3 years in October, as demand across the single currency union deteriorates. The Purchasing Managers Index, the PMI of business activity, dropped to 46.5 last month, down from 47.2 in September, signalling a significant and accelerating contraction in output. October marked the fifth month in a row in which the Purchasing Managers Index, the PMI, came in below the critical 50 threshold that separates expansion from contraction. The Standard & Poor's wrote, "Also pointing to a darkened economic outlook was the stagnation of employment as a 32-month run of job creation came to a halt." The report highlighted October's sharper downturn in activity reflected a worsening performance by service providers as a decrease in factory production levels remained on par with that seen in September. Still, the latest survey data signaled the third month in succession in which output has fallen in both monitored sectors. The research also showed that the declines in output were broad-based across the Eurozone, with the exception of Spain, where private sector activity came in flat in October. Germany and France continued to contract sharply, while Italy posted its fastest downturn since last year. The Republic of Ireland registered its first decline in output in 11 months. Excluding the pandemic-hit months, the recent drop in new business was the steepest since September of 2012, during which time the Eurozone was embroiled in a sovereign debt crisis. Cyrus de la Rubia, chief economist at Hamburg Commercial Bank, said, "It looks like the service sector in the Eurozone is stumbling out of the gates for the final quarter. October marks the third straight month of business activity taking a hit. With new business diving steeply, it is not painting a rosy picture for what is ahead." Economists have warned that economic output in the Eurozone could fall again in the fourth quarter of 2023, which would indicate a recession. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. The European Central Bank, the ECB, warned the balance sheet of Eurozone banks are showing clear signs of stress after rising loan defaults and late payments by customers. The European Central Bank said higher interest rates have boosted banks' income and profits for the time being, but lenders are facing pressure from higher funding costs, worsening asset quality and lower lending volumes. The European Central Bank also warned in its twice-yearly financial stability review that higher interest rates and slower growth were posing problems for people, companies and governments in the euro area. It said higher borrowing costs were likely to lead banks to set more money aside to cover bad debts, hitting future profitability. However, the rise in defaults and late payments has come from a historically low level, and the European Central Bank claims the banking system should be able to cope with worsening asset quality thanks to strong capital buffers and liquidity levels.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ you who believe, اسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. It's been an honor for all of us to be able to benefit from the teachings of Sayyida Fatima and her household to talk about raising Fatimiyun. Now, before I begin my portion, I do want to thank and appreciate, and I think all of us, inshallah, to appreciate all of those who've contributed. In particular, I'd like to mention those or that we remember and pray for those who recited Latmiya and those who recited poetry for us. Brothers and sisters, there's a secret, and there's a reason why there's pushback. Your victory and your protection, is in your youth connecting the dots. Not shying away from the truth. Sayyida Fatima, that qiyam that she did was to get us to stand up for the truth. Not just to have it in our hearts, but to connect the dots. If it's only one person, if it's only Sayyida Zahra, then they can kick in the door. When it's us as a community, when this is how we think as a people, that's when we're a step closer to the victory. So there's a reason why some would not want us to mention our shuhada, to not think or talk or expound on the concept of martyrdom, not for that to be a goal in raising our children. Because that's your victory. That's your protection. So when I would hear the Latmiya being recited and the dots being connected, instead of this being a Fatimiya, where literally we come in and from day one till the end, we make no connection with the dunya, with the dhalimeen, with the modern day oppressors of Sayyida Fatima. For me, that's a shame. The opposite is what everybody should be doing. The question should be on others. How come you can mention Sayyida Zahra and talk about shahada of her and martyrdom and sacrificing yourself and then have the audacity not to mention the wali of the time, not to mention the shimmer of the time, to make it a story and a fable and feel good and go home? That's the mistake. So for me, when I hear the poetry of our sister, the Latmiya that's being recited, that for me, I know that's a victory. Now it's in the hearts, minds, thoughts, and words of the believers. So inshallah, Allah reward all of those who are involved in this in any capacity and raise them with our mother, Sayyida Fatima, salamullahi alayha. What Allah has given us right now is the tawfiq to spend several nights talking about just one of the techniques of our mother. Remember, our mother is someone who Angel Jibra'il from heaven, according to some of our hadith, the highest of the malaika is Jibra'il. Her spiritual station was so high that Jibra'il came to her door to console her, to talk to her. Jibra'il. If she were a man, not would she be one of the prophets, one of the Ulul Azm prophets. That means that our mother, who could have been leading the Ummah from the outward stage, this person turned her focus to raising children, being a wife. That's the station of motherhood. The result of that are those champions. The result of this, and inshallah, we're going to be using some lessons from the students, the direct students of Sayyida Fatima. So inshallah, we benefit. We can prepare ourselves and our children to be, inshallah, those elite soldiers of the Imam of the time. Now, brothers and sisters, very briefly, we would like to go to Sayyida Fatima. And we hope that may Allah raise all of us to be Fatimi. If we could be Fatimi. If we could defend the wali of the time, if we could connect the dots and not be afraid, that's what Fatima was. Night after night, our mother would go door to door. All of that honor that she had gained in the time of Rasulullah, she's putting it out there to people who don't respect her. She told them, she said, help me, assist me. Assist Allah's religion. She went to Ma'ath. She told Ma'ath. She said, help Allah's deen. I'm the daughter of your prophet. Ma'ath said, is there anybody else? She said, nobody else came. He said, well, then there's no benefit in me coming either. Sayyida Zahra, her words are, the imam doesn't come to you, you go to the imam. You have to be ready to sacrifice yourself. You find out who the wali of the time is, and then you approach that wali of the time. You defend them. The last step that she was able to do in order to make this happen was her hidden grave. She told Ali, she said that I want you to give me a kafan at night. Put hunut on me at night. Bury me at night. Don't allow any of those dhalameen to be present. And Ali did just that. And Ali buried her in that hidden grave. The enemy had seen Ali be so patient up until now. When they found out, because people made an uproar, the only daughter of the Prophet died. We weren't there in the funeral. We have to be present. They thought now they could impose this on Ali as well. And they came to dig up the grave of Fatima. When they came to dig up the grave of Fatima, Ali heard. And Ali came. And he was wearing that yellow cloak that he would wear in the time of great difficulty. And he was carrying the sword, Dhulfiqar. And he told them, he said, that up until now I've been patient. Wa amma qabru Fatima. If you dig up that grave, then I will quench the ground with your blood. You see, those were the signs. They knew what would happen if the wali of the time was abandoned. They knew how Karbala would turn out. What happens when you abandon the wali? Hussein was alone on the day of Karbala. All of his companions had died. Our imam went out to face that army of 30,000 people, and we remembered there was one last thing he had to do. So our imam went back to the tents, and he said, give me my small child. He took the small baby, he kissed the baby, and then he brought the baby out there. He said, oh people, in lam tarhamuni, if you're not going to have any mercy on me, farhamu hadha tifl, have mercy on this baby. The enemy shot an arrow and slit the baby's throat from one side to the other. Hussein caught that blood that was spurting up and just threw it up into the heavens. He said, Allah, this is easy because you're watching.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump has picked up the endorsement of Texas Governor Greg Abbott during a visit to U.S.-Mexico border. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump on Sunday, 19th of November, received the endorsement of Texas Governor Greg Abbott for his 2024 presidential bid at a campaign event near the U.S.-Mexico border, a region that has played a pivotal role in the political careers of both Republicans. Greg Abbott, another fierce critic of President Joe Biden's immigration policies, gave Donald Trump an effusive endorsement in Edinburgh, a small city in Texas's Rio Grande Valley, one of the busiest sectors for unlawful border crossings, and an area where Republicans have made inroads with its predominantly Hispanic communities in recent years. After serving meals to Texas National Guard members and troopers involved in the state's border security initiative, known as Operation Lone Star, Donald Trump and Greg Abbott embraced each other on stage, set up in front of Texas law enforcement helicopters, a plane, and an armored vehicle. "We need a president who's going to secure the border," Greg Abbott said. In recent weeks, Donald Trump has escalated his harsh rhetoric on immigration and the scope of his promises on the issue, which some of his advisers believe partially catapulted him to victory over the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2016. In one recent interview, Trump claimed that migrants were poisoning the blood of our country. During his presidency, Donald Trump staged a crackdown on illegal and legal immigration, taking unprecedented actions to cut immigrant admissions, restrict access to the asylum system, build hundreds of miles of border wall, and end temporary deportation protections for hundreds of thousands of immigrants, including those who arrived in the United States as children. But Trump has promised to take his hardline immigration agenda further if he's elected in 2024. Pledging to carry out the largest deportation operation in U.S. history, expand his travel bans, deny birthright citizenship to the American-born children of unauthorized immigrants, and reject legal immigrants with political beliefs he disagrees with. Donald Trump has also refused to rule out reviving his infamous migrant family separation policy, which he discontinued in 2018, after a widespread public outcry. Greg Abbott, who has not yet endorsed a presidential candidate, has also made immigration a top issue during his governorship, turning Texas into a chief adversary to Joe Biden's migration and border measures. Since Joe Biden took office, Greg Abbott has ordered state officials to fortify the banks of the Rio Grande with razor wire and river barriers, directed Texas troopers to arrest migrant adults on trespassing charges, and authorized the state to bus tens of thousands of migrants to Democratic-led cities, mainly New York and Chicago. Greg Abbott is also expected to sign what would be the harshest state immigration law in modern American history. The measure, known as SB 4, will empower state law enforcement officials to arrest migrants on new illegal entry criminal charges and allow state judges to issue deportation orders to suspected violators. After it passed the Texas legislature earlier this month, the bill was denounced as draconian and unconstitutional by the Mexican government, Democratic lawmakers, and the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, which has promised to challenge the measure in courts of law. SB 4 will almost certainly also trigger another legal clash with the Biden administration, as immigration enforcement is a federal responsibility. In recent days, President Biden's re-election campaign has seized on Donald Trump's 2024 immigration promises, casting them as radical and cruel. In a public messaging campaign, it hopes will galvanize Latinos to vote against Trump. Donald Trump has been unapologetically open about the extreme, inhumane, and fundamentally un-American policies that he would enact if he found his way back into the Oval Office. Julie Chavez Rodriguez, President Biden's campaign manager, said at a press briefing, "Joe Biden faces his own political challenges on immigration, one of his worst polling issues. His administration has been under growing pressure from Republicans and many Democrats to limit the entry of migrants along the southern border with Mexico, where migrants' apprehensions have reached record levels over the past 3 years." National broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story. Donald Trump picked up the Texas governor's endorsement on Sunday, 19th of November, during a visit to U.S.-Mexico border town and promised that his hardline immigration policies in a second presidential term would make Greg Abbott's job much easier. "You'll be able to focus on other things in Texas," Trump told Abbott, as they each appeared before a crowd of about 150 at an airport hangar in Edinburgh, Texas. Greg Abbott, a longtime ally and fellow border hawk, said he was proud to endorse the former president, who is the Republican Party's front-runner for the 2024 nomination. "We need a president who is going to secure the border," Greg Abbott said, speaking in a town that is about 30 miles from the Hidalgo port of entry, crossing with Mexico. "We need Donald Trump back as our President of the United States of America." Earlier, Trump served meals to Texas National Guard soldiers, troopers, and others who will be stationed at the border over Thanksgiving. Donald Trump and Greg Abbott handed out tacos, and the former president shook hands and posed for pictures. "What you do is incredible, and you want it to be done right," Donald Trump told them. Greg Abbott said about the Guard members and Texas troopers who are stationed at the border, he said, "They should not be here at this time. They should be at home." He said the only reason why they're here is because we have a president who is not securing our border. Donald Trump has been laying out immigration proposals that would mark a dramatic escalation of the approach he used in office and that drew alarms from civil rights activists and numerous court challengers. Though Trump has peppered campaign speeches with his immigration plans, he only made brief remarks in border country on Sunday. He spoke for only about 10 minutes against the backdrop of state police helicopters, a plane, and an armed patrol boat, all used by Texas at the border. Donald Trump wants to revive and expand his controversial travel ban, which initially targeted 7 Muslim-majority countries. Trump's initial executive order was fought all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which upheld what Trump complained was a watered-down version that included travelers from North Korea and some Venezuelan officials. He also intends to begin new ideological screening for all immigrants, aiming to bar Christian-hating communists and Marxists and dangerous lunatics, haters, bigots, and maniacs from entering the United States. "Those who come to join our country must love our country," he has said. Trump would target foreign nationals on college campuses and revoke the student visas of those who express anti-American or anti-Semitic views. He would also invoke the Alien Enemies Act to remove from the United States all known or suspected gang members and drug dealers. The law was used to justify internment camps during the Second World War. It allows the president to unilaterally detain and deport people who are not U.S. citizens. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Texas Governor Greg Abbott officially endorsed former President Donald Trump for the GOP primary nomination at a Sunday event honoring service members stationed on the Texas-U-Mexico border. Joe Biden is causing a potential terror threat in the United States of America, Greg Abbott said at the event. He added, a president has one ultimate responsibility, and that's national security. Joe Biden has failed at national security. Well, I'm here to tell you that there is no way that America can continue under the leadership of Joe Biden as our president. Greg Abbott added, we need a president who's going to secure the border. We need a president who's going to restore law and order in the United States of America. Not letting these criminals run ransack over the stores that you see images of almost nightly. We need a president who's going to restore world peace as opposed to this outbreak of warfare under Joe Biden. We need Donald Trump back as our president. Greg Abbott, in his speech, also praised Donald Trump's border policies, including Title 42, building a border wall and eliminating the catch-and-release practices that allows immigrants caught in the United States without proper documents to be released from detention while their cases play out in courts of law. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with Iran's sports champions and medalists of the 2023 Asian Games and the Asian Paragames. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyye on November 22, 2023. I would like to thank these dear young people and these dear teenagers. Your work was truly beautiful. It was very good, and I must truly thank their teachers. Much hard work has been put into this, and the outcome is good. These dear brothers, we used to call them Murshid, guide or leader of Zurhane. Back then, I don't know what they are called nowadays. I would like to also thank these brothers. They led and permitted us in Zurhane terms. They truly beat the drums well. They did a great job. Overall, the traditional sport moves that were performed here today were very good. Now, I would like to share two or three things with you, dear athletes, both veteran athletes and young athletes. The first point, which I believe may be the main point, is gratitude and appreciation. I truly feel it is my duty to express my gratitude, first of all, to all the athletes and hardworking people in the area of sports. I would like to thank all those who work hard, put in their effort, and endure hardships in the area of sports. Being in the field of sports requires willpower and determination. You have shown this to us. Our athletes have demonstrated this. Praise God.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to thank the medalists in this field. A medal is a sign, a symbol, an indication of your hard work. I am sincerely grateful to the medal winners. I would like to thank our female athletes. I would like to thank the woman who carried the flag in the opening ceremony during this round of the Asian Games while wearing full hijab. She showed the identity and character of an Iranian woman to the entire world. I would like to thank the female athlete who refused to shake hands with a non-mahram man, not from her intimate family, during the awards ceremony. He extended his hand toward her, but she declined to take it. These are very significant things. These things are just as important as sports are, if not more. I would like to thank the woman who went to the podium with her baby. She went on the podium with her baby in her arms and received her medal. This was a symbolic move. In the world, this shows a woman respecting the role of the family and the role of a mother.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.